Hello, everyone, and welcome to LSC Ideas and today's event on US-China strategic competition from the perspective of financial markets. For all the noise around trade war and tech war, is there actually a financial cold war that's already in play? Is this a battle for who owns or controls both the rails and carriages of financial flows? Will this battle intensify as a result of the tragic war, the Russia-Ukraine war that's raging right now in Europe, and the international response to it? But we have two distinguished speakers, James Fok and Joyce Chang, joining us from two financial centers, literally some 8,000 miles apart, Hong Kong and New York, to talk us through this. But before I introduce them, some housekeeping points. This event is being recorded, going out live on Facebook right now, and we expect it to be published on our YouTube page in a few days. We'd also like this to be as interactive as possible. So please ask questions, put them in the Q&A function on Zoom, and hopefully we'll have a lively discussion going. And we have just under 1 hour in total. All right. So let me now bring in James Fok. James, for some introductory remarks on the subject of today's session, which is inspired by the title of his recent book, Financial Cold War, A View of Sino-US Relations from the Financial Markets. James served as a senior executive at Hong Kong Exchanges and Clearing, HKEX, from 2012 until 2021, during a period of rapid internationalization in China's capital markets. Prior to HKEX, he worked as an investment banker in both Europe and Asia. James, welcome. Your opening remarks, please.
Thank you very much, Lutfi. Thank you very much to LSC Ideas for hosting this event today, and thank you to you all for joining. The tragic events taking place in Ukraine right now serve as a stark reminder of the risks of mismanaging geopolitical tensions. If there is any one lesson that we should take away from that catastrophe, it is that it is vital for policyholders to fully understand the sources of geopolitical tensions and to act early to address them. There are, of course, many dimensions to great power relations. But in the Sino-US relationship, financial factors have played a uniquely important role in the escalation of tensions in recent years. Financial markets serve two fundamental purposes. One, they provide a mechanism for capital to be allocated to its most productive uses. Two, they provide a mechanism for sharing risks. And by serving in these two functions, they have contributed immeasurably to human civilization and development. However, financial markets operate within institutional frameworks. And when those institutional frameworks drive imbalances in the structure of financial markets, they can lead to significant social tensions and conflicts. In the Sino-US financial relationship, there's been a lot of focus on trade as a source of conflict. But if you look at the numbers, trade accounts for only 10% of international cross-border capital flows. Financial flows account for 90%. So if you want to understand fully the financial factors or the financial tensions in the Sino-US relationship, you have to look to the capital markets. So what is the financial cold war? When you use this term, most people's minds immediately jump to trade war, sanctions, the banning of banks from the SWIFT network. By the time you get to that point, though, I would say that you're already in a financial hot war. The financial cold war is the invisible buildup of those tensions over time. And as I define it in my book, at its most fundamental level, the financial cold war is the invisible conflict embedded in national financial policies and the structure of international financial markets over the distribution of wealth. Rising wealth and income inequality in both the US and China have been a significant core source of social tensions. And rather than addressing the source of those tensions, policymakers in both countries have tended to resort to populist nationalism. And any student of history will understand the very acute dangers that that gives rise to. So what are the key battlefronts of this financial Cold War? There are four in my mind. First is the US dollar's role in the international monetary system. The international monetary system that was put in place after the Second World War through the Bretton Woods Agreement lodged the US dollar at the center of the international monetary system. The ill effects of that on many emerging markets that have had to borrow in US dollars that have been pummeled by periodic bouts of currency volatility are very well known. What's less focused on is the cost to the US of the dollar serving in this global utility role. In serving in that role, or for the dollar to serve in that role, the US has had to constantly supply more liquidity, US dollars, to the rest of the world in order to support the growth of trade and investment around the world. I.e., it's had to run a balance of payments deficit. That's been fine when the US economy has been growing at least as fast as the rest of the world, but for many years now, the US has been a mature large economy, and its economy has not been growing as fast as other countries. What this has led to is effectively the US having to go into greater levels of debt, which has created structural fragility in the US financial markets and hence in global financial markets. This system has also created an international demand for dollar, which has denied the US currency from the normal balancing or rebalancing mechanisms that national currencies have and led to a structural overvaluation of the dollar. How this has affected you really depends on where you fall in the US socioeconomic strata. So if you have been the shareholder or wealthy shareholder of a large US corporation that's been able to take advantage of this and outsource production to lower cost centers, these companies have reduced their costs, hence increased their profit margins, and your share price has gone up. If, on the other hand, you have been a US manufacturing worker over the last 40 years, you have not done so well. Your experience has been job loss, it's been displacement, at best, it's been wage stagnation. The second key battlefront in the financial Cold War has been global fiscal competition, which has driven ever more inequitable financial or taxation systems around the world, where quite often middle-class workers are paying far higher rates of taxation than the very wealthy. The third key battlefront is in the failures in antitrust policy and enforcement. This has had several effects. Everyone understands that monopolies and oligopolies tend to lead to higher consumer prices, but they also tend to suppress wages for workers. And they also tend to lead to a reduction in investment in R&D and innovation, and hence drag on long-term productivity and economic prosperity. The fourth battlefront has been in the rather perverse incentive structures that have been created throughout the system. Key nodes in the economic decision-making structure have been incentivized to do things which are counter to the economic benefit of society as a whole. One example of this has been share-based remuneration for corporate executives, who have hence had a large incentive to pursue corporate buybacks as a means of boosting share prices and EPS, rather than running the hard yards of investing in long-term growth in productivity. All of this has contributed to a significant increase in wealth and income inequality. China, of course, over the last 40 years has seen rapid economic development and improvements in living standards. So the issue of wealth and income inequality is not nearly so acute as in the US, but the Chinese now face significant challenges. One of these is its rapidly aging population. Over the next 30, 40 years, China is not only seeing a reduction in its working age population that's driven part of the Chinese economic miracle, it will also see a reduction in its absolute population. For a society that's been dependent on economic growth and has run a top-down investment-led growth model, this poses a significant risk, because this top-down model is leading to ever greater capital misallocation. One factor in that has been the fact that the Chinese economy is now so complex that it defies the ability of economic planners to really allocate capital efficiently. But you know, in a system where local governments have an incentive to pour concrete to drive GDP growth, where you have a declining population, that is clearly leading to significant misallocations. The third key challenge that China's got, and partly as a result of this top-down investment-led growth model that it's got, is that it has failed to develop its capital markets. So when you look at China's wealth deployment today, you've got 78% of household wealth sitting in residential real estate. The next largest deployment of Chinese wealth is in bank deposits. Relatively little is going into capital markets. And so as the country hits the point where it needs its citizens to save for their long-term pensions, retirements, etc., Chinese capital markets are not providing the ability for them to do that. One, because they're not providing the proper price discovery mechanism and hence are seen somewhat as a casino, but also because China is structurally unable at the moment to allow its investors to invest more widely in international capital markets. And in this, the geopolitical conflict that it has gotten into with the US has been a significant problem. Because today, Chinese investors investing in capital markets outside of China beyond Hong Kong are entirely reliant on a Western-controlled custody and depository system. What this means is that, and if you've looked at the mechanisms for US sanctions being imposed on Russia, you will understand that it puts China at significant financial security risk if it allows its citizens to go out in that way. Hence, this geopolitical conflict has created a significant stalemate. It is clearly to the benefit of the Chinese to allow greater portfolio flows to happen. It would be a huge benefit for the rest of the world to be able to receive that Chinese investment. And in fact, it would also reduce one of the sources of geopolitical conflict, in that 1,000 Mrs. Wang investing in a few shares of Apple or Google doesn't create huge geopolitical or security sensitivities, whereas Chinese SOEs going out and buying whole companies through FDI potentially create significant sensitivities. So what should policymakers do about this? Is decoupling the answer? No. It is not, because given the extent to which globalization is intertwined and interconnected trade and financial markets around the world today, that would only make us all worse off. What we need to do is we need to fix the financial markets in a way that removes the structural imbalances and that better distributes the fruits of economic growth and prosperity. That would include balancing the role of markets in the state, preventing elite capture of government so that markets and the state are able to function fairly for society as a whole. It will involve the reform to the global dollar-based monetary system. And it will also require cooperation by all countries on key national and international financial, industrial, fiscal policies, because the butterfly effects of this globalized system in which we operate means that small tweaks in one place will inevitably affect others. This sounds, of course, like a very daunting task, but given the huge importance of this to our future peace, stability, and prosperity, it is a task that we can no longer put off. Thank you.
Thank you very much, James. I have quite a few questions for you. We'll come back to that shortly. Let me introduce Joyce Chang, Managing Director and Chair of Global Research at JP Morgan. Joyce was most recently Global Head of Research, a role she held for more than 5 years between 2014 and 2019. The global research team that covers virtually all sectors and asset classes around the world was recently named the top global research firm by Institutional Investor. Previously, Joyce was head of fixed income research, and before that, an emerging markets strategist. Joyce, welcome. Thank you for joining us. Your opening remarks, please.
Thank you so much. And it's such a pleasure to be with you and to be with James. And I greatly benefited and agree with just so many aspects of his work and his book. I have a presentation, which I'm only gonna show like three or four of the slides that, but what I thought I would do is start with an overview of China's financial market and really endorse the points that James has made, which is that decoupling isn't the answer in this global economy. And one thing I would say about COVID-19 is that it made us really reprice a lot of our macro forecasts about China. The combination of China being the only country that had positive growth in 2020, the 8% growth that it had last year, this year we have growth at around 5%. We think that China will reach the size of the US economy before the end of this decade. So COVID probably accelerated that process by what we think is 3 or 4 years between China's growth and also the currency appreciation. And very much as James said, we do see growth though slowing down in China. And that is in large part because they do have a very rapidly aging population. They have changed the focus to common prosperity and trying to achieve a better balance, address some of this income inequality, and that will lead to a slowdown. Now, how have the financial markets fit into this? Well, China's financial markets have really become too big to ignore. And I'm going to flip to the next slide, because just to show you a snapshot of how these markets have grown. They are second in size only to the US equity and bond markets. And we actually had that in 2020, ironically, even in the year of the pandemic, it was in many ways a watershed year for China's opening of its financial markets. China went into many of the mainstream bond indexes, in allocations. There was a search for yield in a negative yield environment. China also announced, which many people have not focused on, but as part of the phase one trade agreement, there was actually quite a big focus on financial opening. And I'm going to just flip ahead two slides. Yes, and here you can see in 2020, all of the measures that were taken, as part of the phase one trade agreement. So, as James said, everybody talked about the trade, but if you looked at what happened in 2020, China actually announced the elimination of caps on foreign ownership for securities, for fund management, for the future sectors, for life, health, and pension insurance services. And there was, then a tremendous amount of foreign inflows. And I don't think anyone would have thought in the year of the pandemic would also be the year that China achieved sort of record levels of portfolio flows. Now, foreign assets in China are still relatively small given the size of this market. They're in the mid single digit levels. But 2021, with the Common Prosperity Agenda, brought many more challenges. We have seen a number of regulatory changes, market turbulence that are really casting a shadow on China's financial openness. And that includes uncertainty on the rules on China's overseas listed companies, includes the US Holding Foreign Companies Accountability Act on reporting and transparency. There are also possible consequences that are going to follow after the issues of US institutional investors due to what China has announced as part of its education policy, where they force the conversion of all of the kindergarten through elementary school academic tutoring institutions to nonprofit status and a ban on foreign capital in the sector. So, as James said, many of these antitrust and regulatory rules, have really sort of come into focus since Common Prosperity was, announced as a program in last summer. I wanted to just add on to some of James's points as well, and just talk a little bit about the importance of developing the domestic capital markets in China. So taking a look at China at large, right now, China's household savings rate is 34%. 90% of all households own property. And if you look at household wealth and the property issues that have come up right now, this is about 60% of household wealth. That's double what we see in the United States. But if you take a look at the capital markets, financial assets are only 20% of household assets. And there is a need for deeper domestic markets. By comparison, if you look at the United States, financial assets are more than 70%. Of the household assets, so this is one area where, as James has mentioned, there's a tremendous amount of need to develop deeper domestic capital markets. China has announced and drafted measures about this, looking at the asset management industry and how to develop this. Ways in which they can, actually develop their own capital markets. But this is still something that's at a very nascent stage, given the size of the Chinese economy. I wanted to say a bit on the renminbi internationalization as well, and just how we are looking at this. And I'm going to, flip forward, in the deck. And there is a section on renminbi internationalization that starts on slide number 12. And one thing I would say is just that this is really limited by the, until we see that CNY is convertible, there are real limitations on talking about the internationalization. And we see that if you take a look at, the predominance of the dollar for global trade settlement. China, even in China itself, only 15 to 20% of trade is actually settled in CNY. And if we look at cross-border settlement, as a percentage of China's total trade, it actually has not grown that much since about 2015. And the next slides really do illustrate some of these points. And I would just say that if you take a look at overall global foreign exchange reserves, the data collected by the IMF suggests that central banks hold about 60% of their assets in dollar claims. There's another 19% that is held in euros. And, so CNY is still a relatively small part of global FX holdings and only about 2% of the total. So you can see looking at these charts, when we look at the swift use of local currencies, we also look at the cross-border capabilities. And we get many questions also about the China Central Bank digital currency. But I would just say that we don't see this actually having many implications with expect for cross-border flows. And there's an update just on where China has been at right now in the digital currency trial scheme, on the next slide. So, in summary, to provide some background, I would fully agree that decoupling isn't the answer. I think there had been just more discussions on how to open the financial markets to foreigners that had really begun back in 2019, 2020. That whole process had really begun in some of the international financial markets with the inclusion in the indexes. And we actually saw that accelerate in 2020. But we have seen some real shifts away from this with the focus on the common prosperity agenda, with the regulatory tightening that China is putting into place right now. And with the current tensions that we see in Russia, Ukraine, I think that some of this opening that had begun, just may take longer to achieve right now. But I agree very much that defining the relationship only in trade terms misses many of the points that have really spanned into technology, financial linkages that will really define the relationship going forward, particularly as we have seen more geopolitical conflicts break out. So let me stop there.
Joyce, thank you. I was going to start with a question for James, but since I have you here and you mentioned internationalization of the RMB, if I could just take it from there and ask you the first question. I notice in the chart of RMB, the index of internationalization, I think Standard Chartered compiles that index every year. There was a reversal in 2015, 2016, and then it sort of flattened out after that. How should we look at that? Is this something, will RMB ever get internationalized? Is it just something ever going to happen or not? Well, it needs to be different.
Well, the key thing to really consider with RMB internationalization is convertibility. It has to be convertible. And when will that happen? Well, that is a question that really no one can answer. But there's really three stages that we've seen of RMB internationalization. So let me just go through those three stages. So much as you said in this chart, we saw a peak in 2015. From 2010 to 2015, what we had was CNY appreciation. We had the relaxation of capital controls that helped promote financial openness. And we had, really what you can see in that chart is a rapid increase in the international use literature that was actually led by cross-border trade settlement. Then you had really 2015, the CNY depreciation. You had, some very big capital outflows, and you had tighter capital controls that came into place really in the 2015 to 2018 period. Now, when everybody talks about the U.S. trade tensions and the Trump and his policies towards China, what a lot of people fail to really have looked at was how much Trump actually wanted China's market open to U.S. financial institutions, like J.P. Morgan getting a license in China. So from about 2018 until last year, you had the stabilization of the currency. This is one reason why we have re-rated China. You had a new round of financial openness measures. which were part of the phase one trade agreement. And you had a recovery in the international usage of renminbi that was led by foreign investors' portfolio investment that went into China and into FX currency reserves by some of the sovereign wealth funds. Now you have more of a question mark on where that could go as we see some of these financial tightening measures. And So I think it remains, to be seen what will happen, as far as how quickly this trend develops. But convertibility is key, and I think that is something that's still quite distant.
You're right. Now, once you list them out, it looks like there actually have been movements towards more coupling, not decoupling. If you add up these things, the phase one agreement around percentage ownership of foreign interests and so on and so forth. James, if I could come back to you now, and your book has, I think, three sections. You have the backstories of the US, mainly the dollar for the last 100 years. You have the backstory of China. Interestingly, the Chinese story starts in 1421, so it's clearly a very long arc that you portray. I want to come to the role of the dollar in the international system, because I'm used to hearing about it as an exorbitant privilege that the US unambiguously enjoys. It's a positive thing. You have phrased it also as some kind of a burden for the US. Do you want to talk us through that one more time, please? Are you really saying that some sort of controlled reduction in the status and international use of the dollar is beneficial to the US as well?
Look, I mean, the typical perception is that the dollar has been a source of exorbitant privilege at the expense of other countries. And I think that narrative rather ignores the huge benefit that the dollar serving in that role has had to other countries, because by serving in that role, it's provided a vehicle for the growth of global trade and investment, and it has provided prosperity to a huge number of countries around the world. The benefits to the US, I think, are less easy to discern now. Although it allows the US to borrow very cheaply in international markets, et cetera, and it avoids the currency mismatch risks that many other countries face, the reality is that it has led to overconsumption, and particularly has led the US down the path of engaging in many policies that, if it were to have had some financial constraints, it may not, or traps that it would not have fallen into. And I'm thinking here in the many wars of choice that the US has engaged in recent decades. And when you look at a currency from the perspective of the country, you've got to really look at whether it has provided a greater level of prosperity to the population as a whole. When you look at it today, I would say that the majority of the US population is no longer benefiting from the dollar serving in that role, because it has contributed to an acceleration in the US's loss of competitiveness relative to other countries. And while the dollar may be held up for a much longer time, as it increases its level of debt, as the currency has effectively been debased during that, there is a greater risk that it is going to lead to a significant destabilizing rupture. We don't know what the precise catalyst for that will be, but as the level of imbalance has grown, the system has become more fragile.
Okay. All right, that makes sense. And then on the China side of the story, one thing that perhaps surprises people is that there is that tension between conservatives and reformers, not just in the US, but also in China. And, I would have thought of Deng Xiaoping or later on Zhu Rongji as these supreme leaders, and you say you do this and that gets done. But from your narrative, it looks like there has been much more of a lot of decentralized variation in the approaches, much more of incremental, almost experiments with special economic zones and so on and so forth. Is it still the case in terms of the operating context, or is it more monolithic now? And if so, is the system more brittle from a risk point of view going forward?
I think without a doubt, you've seen a greater level of centralization in the political decision-making structure in the last decade or so. And there have been good reasons for that, because under the previous administration, you'd had significant problems with widespread corruption, other issues that were undermining the political legitimacy of the government. And so the centralization was carried out to address some of those problems. But the problem is that when you have that sort of centralization, you know, leave aside, you know, whole countries and governments, even in typical corporations that you work in, where you have this centralized decision-making structure and very significant hierarchies, where it's difficult to put forward opposing points of view, you tend to then create risks. And you know, that I think is that is a problem that the Chinese economy faces today, particularly because the real driver of Chinese economic growth and prosperity has been the private sector. And certainly there are huge problems, not just in China, but around the world with corporate power, corporate monopolies, and particularly, you know, concentrations in power from these internet platforms and so forth. And certainly those need to be addressed. But the lack of due process, I think, can create unintended consequences, because it potentially disincentivizes businessmen and entrepreneurs from enterprise and innovation that have helped drive China's economic miracle.
I think you also quote a proverb: mountains are high, the emperor is far away. So the possibility of policy missteps, if everything is centralized, is certainly real. Before I go to Joyce with my next question, one more quick one for you, James. You have a chapter titled Two Steps Forward, One Step Backwards. Where are we with this RMB internationalization right now? Are we in the two steps forward phase or the one step backward phase right now?
Well, I think I probably approach this question slightly differently to Joyce. Joyce has been looking in terms of the sort of macroeconomic effects of that. But when you look at the question of RMB internationalization, it's internationalized because of very practical reasons. More Chinese people are going on holiday overseas, more Chinese businesses are doing business overseas, and hence there has had to be a greater level of internationalization and a greater level of convertibility, not full convertibility. But I would say that today the capital account is either semi-closed or semi-open, depending on whether you're a glass half full or half empty sort of a person. But when you look at the overall policy direction, there is still a big tussle among key policymakers. The banner of RMB internationalization has been a very significant and useful rallying cry to allow some of those practical steps to be taken. But at the fundamental level, there is still a very big wariness of allowing the Chinese currency to internationalize on the same model as the dollar. And the big reason for that is that Chinese policymakers have looked at the costs of that dollar system to US society and to US workers, and they're very wary of allowing their currency to serve in that role. That's what's driven the very slow and cautious approach to renminbi internationalization. And it is also the reason why back in 2009, just after the financial crisis, you may remember that the then governor of the People's Bank of China, Zhou Xiaoquan, made a speech advocating not for the renminbi to serve in a greater role, but for IMF SDRs to serve as the global reserve currency rather than any single national currency. And in fact, that view was echoed by Yi Gang, the now governor of the PBOC, in an article he wrote for the Financial Times in the middle of 2020.
Right.
Chinese policymakers do want to provide that the channels for more Chinese trade internationally, etc., but they do not want to take all of the financial imbalances of the rest of the world.
Right. Okay, we'll come back to this. There's a question in the Q&A box about the Chinese attempt to create an alternative to SWIFT. So I'll come back to you with that one. Joyce, I have two questions for you. One will be about US-China relations. But before that, just on China, one last question looking at China. For the year, this year, stability is the priority objective of the Chinese economy. How realistic is that, given where we are? Are we going to see U-turns, or is it going to be fine-tuning? Will we see bailouts or no bailouts, or will there be some controlled defaults allowed to happen here and there? Is there risk for system-wide contagion, or maybe starting from the property sector? Or is it really going to be about quality growth, you know, common prosperity, dual circulation, all of that? Help us frame how we should respond. Should we panic every time there's something negative, or is it all part of a grand plan?
Well, I would just start by saying that China is in many ways desynchronized from the rest of the world. It is, you know, the only country where inflation had actually been going down and where they had the ability to put policy easing in place as all of the developed market central banks and many of the emerging market central banks began last year with a hiking cycle in emerging markets and are set to begin in the developed markets. So I think that China, you know, is very much focused on stability in front of the Chinese Communist Party meeting. And I think they will be able to achieve that. There's a few things I would say that really set China apart. I do think that they will do more easing, but I think they will do it much more through credit easing. You could have maybe one more triple R cut, but I think it will be much more through credit easing. And we're seeing signs of that on the property sector side. Loosening
easing. This is directed credit to particular sectors. Is that what you mean?
Well, yes, and also just removing some of the restrictions that they had put into place on, like, mortgages on the property sector. Now, the property sector is their Achilles heel. As I mentioned, a property is 60% of household wealth. It is 15 to 20% of GDP. It is the key problem that they need to deal with. And this is where we have seen them put in some credit easing measures. And what we've also seen is that they are trying to front load more of this, because the first quarter really was a very weak quarter because of Omicron. So if China is to achieve this 5.5% growth target that they laid out, they would really need to see, you know, over 6%, 6.5% growth for the next three quarters of the year. Now, overall, we're taking the growth forecast down globally because of what's happening in Russia and Ukraine. But the other thing I would say that really sets China apart as we look at what's happening in the commodity markets right now, where it's not just oil and gas, we're seeing in wheat, in metals, commodity prices rallying, is that China really has been stockpiling commodities since about 2019. So the rest of the world is short commodities, but China is not. So I do think that this trend that we have seen since COVID, that, you know, China is in many ways desynchronized from the rest of the world, is one that you can see continue this year, and that they do have the scope to put in more easing measures, which I think will be directed more towards the property sector, just given the scale of the problem.
So, and the other question is about now taking the US perspective, particularly the DC perspective, looking at US-China relations, the legislations through Congress, the fact that there's a Biden administration as opposed to a Trump administration, does that actually make any difference? What's the political climate there? Can we actually get any of those good things that James has mentioned, or does it look like they're unrealistic?
Well, I think with all of the concerns right now about critical infrastructure, the security of the supply chain, with that being in focus right now, I think you will see the bill in Congress that passed in the House at the beginning of February that's focused on innovation. I do think that will probably gain approval in the Senate and pass the Congress, sometime over the course of the summer, maybe June or July. And so this bill has two parts. There's what they call the CHIPS Act, which is really to, secure, chips. And then there is also just, basically, they want fiscal stimulus into investing critical infrastructure, before the midterm elections. One thing that is included in the proposal, which is like a 4,000-page proposal, but which really does bear monitoring, there's also a proposal to create an office within the USTR that would basically be in charge of approving all outward investment that goes to China. Now, very few people have really talked about this or taken a look at this, but this is really important in my view, because it would set a precedent of having to have approval, much like China does, of where outward investment goes. And that is not something that has really been in place in the US before. Now, the US has just put into place a ban on new investment in Russian energy as well. But if you take a look at the numbers that have been put out by the Rhodium Group, they estimate that if this went into place, about 43% of the outbound investment from the US to China could be scrutinized. So I would just say that, with the mood right now very much focused on critical infrastructure, supply chain concerns, I do think that this Innovations Act, which was called Endless Frontier, it had many different names, which has been now put together in one act, passed the House by 222 votes in favor of it, I think that does have a good chance of passing the Senate. And there are ways in which the administration does want to see this go into play so that there can be some stimulus for investment in the critical infrastructure before the midterm election.
Got it. Thank you, Joyce. So James, let's take a question from Q&A, and I've been trying to incorporate bits and pieces of some of the questions in what I've been asking you guys. And Joyce, if there's any question in the box that you want to answer, please feel free to point those out to me. James, the one I'd like us to look at is the one from Yunnan Chen. There's two parts to that question. The first one, how do you see the future for Chinese ambitions to set up an alternative to SWIFT? So we know about the SIP system, for example. And the second question, what does a reform of the dollar-based monetary system actually look like?
So two big questions. The SIPS system today, I think, really depends on a number of factors. And actually, SIPS is probably not the most determinative factor in reducing Chinese dependence on the dollar system or the dollar network. SIPS has today, I think, around about 1,300 users or members. That compares with over 11,000 for SWIFT. So in terms of network effects, although SIPS provides a useful channel for payments that bypass SWIFT, the reality is that given there are far fewer users of it, it has nowhere near the same network power as SWIFT. And in fact, the messaging networks for international payments are really only one factor. They don't actually address the actual pipework of how the money moves. And that's one of the key problems here, in that even if the money can move in and out of the country, then it needs to move through pipework that doesn't necessarily touch the US system. And also, counterparties to Chinese trade need to be willing to accept more renminbi. And one of the big problems that counterparties in trade relationships with China have is that if you receive renminbi, or if you invoice and receive renminbi on your part, what can you redeploy that capital into? There are very few renminbi denominated securities in international markets for you to deploy into, whereas you have a huge plethora of US dollar denominated investments. And while you say that you can go and invest that money in China through the Stock Connect or Bond Connect or channels that have opened up, that the reality is that many, particularly large holders of the currency, are wary of putting that capital onshore in China because there's still significant distrust over property protection rights within the Chinese system. And so until and unless you have either or both of a far greater number of Chinese denominated investments sitting in the offshore market, or you have greater faith in the property rights protections in the domestic markets, I see it is still being very difficult to bypass the US dollar system because trade counterparties generally want to receive international currencies like the dollar. Going to the second question, and this is a hugely complex topic, and chapter 8 of my book provides a framework for thinking about how you might do this, but it is certainly not exhaustive, and certainly is intended more as food for thought. But by and large, there are kind of three ways of doing this. One is that you move towards a neutral international currency. Originally, when the Bretton Woods system was set up, actually John Maynard Keynes has suggested not to use any national currency, but to set up a new currency called Bancor. Today, we have the IMF special drawing rights that could serve as the basis of an international currency. But in order for it to do that, you'd have to have huge networks set up. You'd have to have networks of borrowing. You'd have to have derivative markets set up using that particular currency unit as a benchmark so that people can hedge interest rate risk, so they can hedge FX risk, so they can hedge commodity price risks and so forth. The barriers to replacing the dollar system in that way are very, very high, and it would take a very long time. Some alternatives that could come up are that you move to more of a multipolar or bipolar international currency system. But the problem with that is that because of the network efficiencies of having a global currency, markets will, even if you have a gradual rise in, say, renminbi as an international currency, markets will ultimately pick a winner because it is so much more efficient to have one single transaction unit for everyone to use. The third alternative, and this people may balk at, but if everyone were to recognize that the US dollar serves as a global utility, but there is a significant cost in terms of lost productivity or lost competitiveness to the US of it serving in that role, you could have a system whereby other currencies actually pay an explicit price to the US rather than the sort of ambiguous channels that you have for it paying through accumulation of dollar debt. Actually have some specific rebate provided to the US for allowing its currency to serve in that role. Although I'm relatively skeptical of that option, just simply because I think that people will tend to balk at the idea of paying another country to run big deficits.
Okay, so I will end with a question for both of you. But before that, Joyce, there is a question directed at you by Lee Jones. This is about Russian forex reserves. It says 13% of Russian forex reserves are in RMB. Given all you have rightly said about the limits of RMB internationalization, how useful is this going to be for Russia in the context of current sanctions?
Well, China cannot save Russia from current sanctions, but the direction of trade between China and Russia had been increasing steadily since the first set of sanctions were put in 2008 and 2014. And we're also just seeing that even with Russian oil that's in the market, you know, it's being self-sanctioned. Nobody is buying it, but China bought some at a $28 discount. So I think that China, you know, will actually use this as an opportunity to, you know, even deepen its trade further, you know, with Russia and arbitrage that opportunity, as you've seen foreign companies leaving. And that's a trend that really started even before, you know, the invasion. But, you know, the cross-border system that China has in place can't relieve, you know, Russia, you know, from the global sanctions. And what we do see is that since it is settlement in, you know, RMB, there are real limitations on it. But I do see that the Russia-China trade relation will deepen more, and that, you know, we really look at what China has done with North Korea as the playbook for how they're handling sanctions. You know, they will not have their big policy banks or the commercial banks, you know, really transact with Russia. They will not violate the sanctions. But what they have done is set up these special purpose vehicles where they don't care if they're sanctioned, because the only thing they do is trade with North Korea. They could do something like that with Russia. So I think that, what we have seen Russia do is actually say, look, we're going to make the payments in rubles, and then it's your problem to find the dollars. So we just have to see how some of this ends up playing out.
Okay, well, thank you for that. And we're almost at the end of our time. Okay, I'll ask the question anyway. Let's see if you have a minute or so to answer. Then the question is really about, is all said and done, and James's story is one of, look, this is a system-wide global systems issue. The two are intertwined, US and China. They have domestic imbalances to deal with, and then you have these issues there. There are no heroes or villains in that story. But my question is there a fundamental contradiction between what China needs to do, it seems, which is China needs more marketization? You mentioned they need more capital markets for domestic savings to channel into. It will need some measured liberalization of its capital account, all of those things. But is there a fundamental contradiction between that versus the structure of central command? And if that contradiction cannot be resolved, will China ever enjoy the kind of soft power that is required for others, third parties, to voluntarily start adopting Chinese currency and assets as part of the system? It's a small question. Don't know if you have a response to that.
I think when you look at this, clearly there are huge vested interests at all layers within society to keep part of the status quo, or all of the status quo. But when you look at, and China provides probably the best example of any country in this, over time systems evolve as society evolves. And so I believe that the Chinese system will evolve to meet its needs. And I believe that its needs will incorporate, you know, greater property right protections, because it will be in its own self-interest to provide that. There may be significant tussles within society in order to get to that point. But I'm fairly confident that the Chinese system will adapt over time to meet those requirements. I think when you look at this, though, from the other perspective, is also that there's a lot of commentary on the faults of the Chinese political system, but there have clearly also been significant failures in the systems in place in the liberal democratic West. The systems have failed to address many of the structural problems that exist there. And I think, you know, rather than looking at, you know, either side as being, you know, a hero or a villain, The important thing is to recognize that both systems have their advantages and their flaws, and that they both have a lot to learn from each other, and they both need to evolve over time.
Thank you, James. Joyce, you have the last word.
Well, I think in the US, the view is that you need to be strategic about this. So in the US, they call this the three C's. So there is, where are the areas where it's cooperation, and health issues, come into this? Where are there areas where there is just real confrontation? The second C, and human rights, democracy issues, where the US has taken a stance on this. And then where is it where it's a competitive relationship? So I think very much, as James points out, that, there isn't such a thing as decoupling, but there are different ways in which I think in this great power struggle, everyone has identified the issues into different spheres, and the way that they will, interact with each other, and wanting it to be something where there is cooperation. There is now real competition and strategic competition in certain sectors, and the supply chain issues point to that. But there's also areas of confrontation on the political model, and we are seeing that play out right now as we watch everything that's happening in the Russia-Ukraine conflict and the triangularity of that relationship. When you add in China as well.
Thank you, Joyce. Thank you, James. With that, we've come to the end of our time today. My apologies to those whose questions I wasn't able to get to. I tried to incorporate as many of those as possible, but I certainly learned a lot. So thank you all for your time. And until next time, all the best. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.